Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going to tackle a really crucial area for anyone heading into the legal field, especially if you're interested in the nuts and bolts of securities litigation. We're going to unpack the complexities of partial settlements and, importantly, the rights of defendants who don't initially settle. We'll do this through the lens of a landmark case, Eichenholz v. Brennan.
That's right. And think of this as, you know, essential knowledge. Eichenholz really shines a light on this fundamental tension you see in big multi-party lawsuits. How do courts encourage settlement, which brings efficiency, closure, without kind of unfairly sticking it to those who decide to litigate? So our goal today is really to dissect this case, understand its reasoning, and see its lasting impact.
Exactly. We're not just going to read off a case summary. We want to give you the core understanding, what happened, why it matters, and what the key takeaways are for your future practice. So to set the scene, this whole thing started with a securities fraud lawsuit. It involved International Thoroughbred Breeders, or ITB, and their plans for the Garden State Racetrack.
Right. And what really made this case a big deal was this controversial bar order that got tucked into a partial settlement. This had huge implications for one of the defendants who didn't settle, First Jersey Securities.
Okay. And we'll be drawing from the Third Circuit's opinion itself and also a standard case brief, just to get, you know, a couple angles on it. So let's dive in. What actually happened? What kicked off this whole legal fight?
Well, at its heart, the lawsuit came about because ITB was trying to raise money through securities offerings to basically overhaul the Garden State Racetrack. But then investors came forward alleging that ITB had made, well, significant misstatements and also left out really crucial information of those offerings.
Okay, typical securities fraud claim foundation then.
Pretty much. These allegations form the basis for claims under the federal securities laws and also under IQ, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. Basically, investors were saying, hey, you misled us and we lost money because of it.
Got it. So you've got the basic claim of wrongdoing. How did this then turn into a situation with only some defendants settling at the partial settlement piece?
Yeah, well, as often happens in these big complex cases with lots of defendants, some of them in this instance, ITB and some related entities, they decided to cut a deal with the plaintiffs fairly early on. They wanted out.
So they settled their part of the case? Makes sense.
Right. They opted to settle their portion of the claims.
Okay, now this is where it gets tricky, right? With this bar order thing, how did that complicate life for First Jersey Securities, the ones left standing?
Precisely. That settlement agreement between the plaintiffs and ITB and the others, it included this thing called a bar order. And what that essentially did was prevent the defendants who didn't settle at that point, like First Jersey, from later turning around and trying to get contribution or indemnification from the parties who had settled.
Okay. Contribution and indemnification. These are key legal terms here. Can you break those down for us in this context? What's the difference?
Absolutely. So contribution in this legal world, it means the right of one defendant, if they're found liable, to basically get a proportionate share of the damages paid by other defendants who are also found responsible for the same harm.
Mm.
You share the cost based on fault.
Okay, shared responsibility.
Right. Indemnification, though, that's different. That's about shifting the entire burden of liability onto someone else. So if indemnification was allowed here, First Jersey could potentially try to make ITB and the others who settled pay for the entire judgment against First Jersey, assuming one happened.
Ah, okay. Big difference. So with this bar order blocking First Jersey's path against the settling guys, what was the central legal question the Eichenholz court really had to wrestle with? What was the core tension?
The fundamental question really was, how do you balance these two competing interests? On one hand, you have this really strong public policy favoring settlements. They save time, money, court resources, you know. But on the other hand, you have to ensure basic fairness to the defendants who don't settle early. You can't let them get stuck holding a disproportionate share of the liability just because others settled out.
Right. It's about making settlement attractive, but not weaponizing it against those who stay in the fight.
Exactly. Incentivizing resolution without creating an unfair disadvantage.
So let's focus on the legal battle itself. What was First Jersey's main argument against this bar order? Why did they think it was unfair?
Well, First Jersey's core argument was pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
They argued this bar order unfairly robbed them of their legal rights to seek contribution or indemnification from the defendants who settled. Their big worry was, hey, we could end up being found liable for all the damages, and we won't be able to go after anyone else who might have also been at fault because they already cut a deal and got protection. They felt like they were being set up to potentially hold the entire bag.
Yeah, that's a serious concern. So How did the Third Circuit Court of Appeals tackle this? What was their reasoning? What were the main points they made?
The Third Circuit's analysis really rested on three key pillars. First, they definitely acknowledged that tension we talked about, the policy favoring settlement versus the defendant's contribution rights. They recognized, look, settlements are good for the system, they promote efficiency, they bring finality, and the bar order helps achieve that certainty for the settling parties. It makes settling more appealing.
Okay, so the bar order helps the settlers. But how did the court deal with the fairness issue for First Jersey, the non-settler?
This is where they brought in this really critical concept, proportionate judgment reduction. The Third Circuit endorsed this method as the way to balance everything out. And here's the key difference. If the non-settling defendants, like First Jersey, were later found liable at trial, their liability wouldn't just be reduced by the dollar amount the others settled for. No.
Okay, so how does it work then?
Instead, their liability gets reduced by the settling defendant's determined share of fault for the harm. So whatever percentage of the blame is eventually assigned to the settling parties, that percentage gets knocked off what the non-settling defendant has to pay.
Ah, I see. That's a really elegant solution, actually. So First Jersey would only ever pay for its own share of the blame, not pick up the slack for those who settle cheap, potentially.
Exactly right. The court reasoned this proportionate reduction method adequately protected First Jersey's contribution rights, because ultimately they'd only be on the hook for their own determined share of the liability, no matter what the settlement amount was. It prevents them from unfairly carrying the weight of the settling party's fault.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so point one was this balance between settlement and contribution rights managed by proportionate reduction. What was the second major point in the court's reasoning?
The second critical point honed in on that distinction between indemnification and contribution, especially when you're talking about securities fraud. The court was very firm here. They said, look, federal securities laws do allow for contribution among joint wrongdoers, but they do not provide, explicitly or implicitly, for a right to indemnification in securities fraud cases.
So a clear no-go on indemnification, what was the thinking behind that? Why treat it differently from contribution?
It really came down to public policy. The court stressed that allowing someone to be indemnified for securities fraud, basically, letting them off the financial hook even if they committed fraud, would seriously undermine the whole point of the securities laws, which is to deter bad behavior.
Right. It removes the financial consequences.
Exactly. If you could commit fraud and just have someone else pay the damages via indemnification, where's the incentive to act honestly in the market? It would harm investors and damage market integrity.
I seem to remember the court using some pretty strong language on this point.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm.
The Third Circuit famously stated that indemnification for securities law violations is against public policy. Full stop. They felt it was essential to keep that deterrent effect strong, ensuring that people involved in selling securities have a direct financial stake in being truthful.
Okay, very clear. No indemnification for securities fraud.
Got it.
What was the third key piece of the Third Circuit's analysis then?
The third point kind of circled back to contribution. While the bar order did stop First Jersey from directly suing the settling defendants for contribution, the court emphasized that the proportionate judgment reduction mechanism effectively preserved this right, just in a different form. By making sure First Jersey's potential liability was capped at its own share of the fault, the court maintained that core principle of shared responsibility. It did this without allowing direct lawsuits against the settlers, which, you know, could blow up the whole settlement.
Got it. So the bar order changed how contribution worked, but didn't eliminate the underlying principle thanks to that proportionate reduction. Okay, let's shift gears slightly to procedure. What about a non-settling defendant like First Jersey wanting to object? Can they challenge a settlement with a bar order?
Yes, they can. This involves the idea of standing to object. The court made it clear that non-settling defendants do have the right to challenge a proposed settlement, including a bar order, if they can show they would suffer legal prejudice because of it.
And what counts as legal prejudice? Is it just annoyance that others settled?
No, it has to be more concrete than that. It needs to be some tangible negative impact on their ability to defend themselves or to seek appropriate contribution later on. Just the fact that others got out of the case isn't enough.
Okay. And when the court in Eichenholz was deciding whether the settlement itself, bar order and all, was fair and reasonable, what specific things did they look at?
Well, the Third Circuit looked at what the trial court considered. Key factors included, one, that a lot of discovery had already happened, so everyone kind of knew the lay of the land, the strengths and weaknesses of the case. Two, they considered the inherent risks and costs of continuing the litigation for everyone. Trials are uncertain. And three, they looked at whether the settlement actually offered a reasonable chance of recovery for the plaintiffs, the investor class. Sometimes getting something is better than risking getting nothing later.
So it wasn't just about First Jersey's concerns. It was a bigger picture assessment of fairness for everyone involved.
Precisely. The court weighed everything, and ultimately they concluded that, given all these factors, and crucially, the safeguard of proportionate judgment reduction, the bar order was acceptable in this case. The benefits of promoting settlement in this complex situation, balanced by the protection for First Jersey, tipped the scales in favor of approval.
It really sounds like trial courts have a lot of leeway, a lot of discretion when approving these kinds of settlements, doesn't it?
That's definitely true. The court highlighted the broad discretion district courts have, as long as they carefully consider everyone's interests, settlers and non-settlers, and put safeguards in place, like that proportionate reduction rule, to protect the rights of those left litigating.
Now, even though the court found the balance okay in Eichenholz, there's often this critique, right, that plaintiffs might use these bar orders strategically to squeeze the remaining defendants.
Yes, that's a very real concern, and it comes up a lot. The argument is that plaintiffs might settle with some defendants, maybe even on somewhat favorable terms for those defendants, specifically to get that bar order in place. This isolates the remaining defendants and potentially increases the pressure on them to settle too, perhaps on terms less favorable than they might have gotten otherwise. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a potential tactical move.
That makes sense from a strategic perspective, even if it feels a bit sharp. What's the counterargument? Why allow bar orders at all if they can be used that way?
Well, the counterargument, and this is really central to the court's thinking, is that without the possibility of bar orders, settlements in these big multi-defendant cases might become incredibly difficult, maybe even impossible in some situations. If defendants knew that even after settling, they could still be dragged back into court by non-settlers seeking contribution, why would they ever settle?
Right. The settlement wouldn't buy them actual peace.
Exactly. It wouldn't provide finality. So bar orders, despite the potential for strategic use, are seen as a necessary tool to actually get some resolution in these complex cases, which ultimately might benefit everyone, including the plaintiffs, who get some recovery sooner rather than later.
It's such a delicate balancing act. You encourage settlement, but you try not to make it totally unfair for those left behind. This really highlights why Eichenholz is still such a key case, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Eichenholz is so significant because it essentially created the playbook for how courts should handle partial settlements in securities litigation, especially when bar orders are involved. It provided that crucial guidance on navigating the tightrope between wanting settlements and needing to protect the rights of non-settling defendants. Courts still look back to the principles it laid down.
And what would you say are the most important principles or takeaways from Eichenholz that are still really relevant today?
Well, I think there are three main ones. First, the basic idea that bar orders can be okay. They're a permissible tool to help settle complex securities cases. Second, that really strong statement against indemnification for securities fraud, that public policy rationale is still very powerful. And third, the importance of proportionate judgment reduction as the mechanism, the safety valve, that protects the contribution rights of the non-settlers.
So, thinking about our listeners, the law students who might soon be dealing with these kinds of cases, what are the practical implications? What should they keep in mind from Eichenholz?
Oh, understanding Eichenholz is vital if you're going into securities litigation. It tells you right away about the limits on indemnification that's huge for defense strategy. It also forces you to really scrutinize any proposed settlement with a bar order. You have to ask, is it fair? How exactly will proportionate reduction work here? It shapes how non-settling defendants and their lawyers approach the whole case.
All right, great points. As we start to wrap up this deep dive on Eichenholz v. Brennan, let's just quickly recap the main lessons.
Sure. So Eichenholz really shows courts walking this tightrope in securities cases with partial settlements. They want to encourage settlements for efficiency, but they also have to protect the defendants who don't settle. The big takeaways are bar orders can be used, but indemnification for securities fraud is pretty much off the table because it guts deterrence. And critically, proportionate judgment reduction is the key mechanism courts use to make sure non-settlers still effectively get their contribution rights protected, meaning they only pay their fair share.
That's a perfect summary. And maybe one last thing for our listeners to ponder as they continue their studies. Think about how these Eichenholz principles, balancing settlement goals with individual rights, might pop up in other areas of complex litigation, maybe outside of securities law. And what are the ethical tightropes lawyers walk when advising clients caught up in these partial settlement and bar order situations? Just some food for thought.
Excellent point. Huh? Until next time, keep digging into the law, keep asking questions, and keep learning.
Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.